Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And hey, we have a cool episode for you today. We interviewed the fabulous Judd Trichter, who played Richie Zelay on the episodes Requiem from season 7 and This Is Not Happening from season 8. And we had a blast talking to him, Jen.
Yeah. It was awesome.
So much fun. So much fun talking about his experience on the show. And we are excited to play that interview for you. But first, we have some tweets of the week to read.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay. Tweets of the week. These tweets are in response to our most recent episode, which was an interview with Chris Logan, who played Dr. Sanjay in the season 10 episode Founder's Mutation. And it was such a very cool and interesting conversation with Chris, and I think the listeners really enjoyed it. From Ray Noel, Ray Noel says, really enjoyed this podcast. Chris sounds lovely. He is a funny guy and loved listening to all his X-Files adventures and stories. Thank you, Jen and Annie, for making this happen. You're welcome, Ray. We found him to be a really funny and lovely guy as well. So thank you for that. From Isadub said, Chris is so fun and charming, and yet he's a master at playing the guy who suffers and is dead. Thanks, Isadub. Yeah, he is a master at playing the guy who suffers and is dead. But he does seem really different in real life, right? Because he's so like, he's basically in pain for the whole episode on The X-Files. But then you talk to him and like, he turns out to be just this really like, easygoing, fun, very sweet guy. So
Well,
I don't know what I pictured, but I didn't picture that.
He apparently plays many characters that die. So
he's really good at it.
Really great at it.
He's good at many things, I think. Casey said, love this interview with Chris. I remember seeing him for a split second in the season 10 trailer and thinking, that was Chris, which I think I shouted at him on Facebook. Anyway, great guest, great host, great podcast. P.S. I laughed out loud at the Piper story. Merrick's Forever. Can you enlighten us, Eddie, about this Merrick's Forever mysterious mention that Casey makes?
I can. Well, Casey, I might have brought up in the interview. I don't remember if we aired it or not. Should I say aired? Is that like old school speak?
I don't know.
But Casey introduced me to Chris. So the three of us, we met up for margaritas at Merrick's. And so what a memory. That's what Merrick's is. It's a Mexican restaurant in Santa Monica. Or is it West Hollywood? Maybe it's West Hollywood. It's on Santa Monica, I believe. I could be remembering this wrong. I was very drunk. But anyway, all of that to say, Merrick's Forever.
Merrick's Forever. I'm going to have to check out this Merrick's. Is it still there? Does it still exist?
I believe so. I have not been in years because I have kids now and I can't do anything fun. But
you're not really part of the Merrick's scene at the moment. Well, if I ever find myself in that part of the world, I'm just obviously going to have to go and have the Merrick's experience.
Yes.
From Sunday says, wonderful listen. So interesting to hear the behind the scenes workings. And Chris seems like a lovely, funny guy. I have a need to go watch Connie and Carla now. Yeah, definitely, Sunday, you should. Just to confirm, this part is in response to our tweet of the week last time. Just to confirm, Jen, yes, pants in the UK means underwear and is also slang for shit, crap, or rubbish. An apt description of the monster, I thought, considering it was made from all those things. That's the monster from Arcadia, which was what we were discussing last time and the tweet to which we were responding. So thank you, Sunday, for clarifying in your tweet our responses to your previous tweets. So thank you for that. Thank you for clarifying. And thank you for enlightening us further about the wonderful world of British English versus North American English. We all think we're speaking the same language, but sometimes we're not. So thanks for that. And thanks, everyone, for your tweets. They are always appreciated. You can tweet at us at any time at XFD Podcast. We look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
Judd Trichter, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
My pleasure.
So I wanted to ask you, first off, about your audition process in terms of getting this part. Do you remember anything about that?
I do. It was Rick Milliken, I think, was the casting director. I had been an actor from the time I was 12, and I had done tons of one-hour procedural television shows. Rick had cast me in I don't know how many shows before. or maybe he was a bunch after, I can't quite remember, but Rick was someone who called me in a lot. I came in, there were three or four people in the room that were, I guess, affiliated with X-Files. I didn't know who they were. I said hello. I shook everybody's hand. There was one person who wouldn't shake my hand. I guess she was a germphobe. And I have a good memory for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
I went to sit down in the chair to begin the audition, and a gentleman with long hair said, "Would you mind standing?" And he said it in a way that was very gruff, which I really liked. And I think I kind of smiled a little bit and laughed, put the chair aside, did the audition, said thank you, left, and then, you know, was informed a day or two later that I got the role.
Wow, that's really funny. Like, that was just the way he wanted you to do the performance? I mean, that's like standing?
Or it was there was so much more to that moment. It's kind of hard to explain, but it was sort of a way of saying he was letting me know what kind of director he was, and I was letting him know what kind of actor I was. And I would say I probably booked the role in that moment.
Wow, that's actually really cool.
Yeah, cool.
You were mentioning earlier that you didn't really have a whole lot of X-Files prior experience, or I should say exposure. When you went in and when you were reading this script, like, were you just literally like, what the hell is this show? Like, what would have been your reaction to that? Not ever.
No, I don't know. I think I looked at it. It looked like I was chasing UFOs. I knew the show had something to do with UFOs. I was like, all right, I'm some kid. I'm looking for UFOs. Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It wasn't rocket science. It was
right. But I mean, clearly you were aware that this was a you know, a huge show, and like you kind of knew the main idea, I would assume. Or
oh,
no?
Yeah, the show had been on for 10 years already. I just wasn't, you know. I remember when it first came on. I don't know. I mean, maybe I was in college or something like that, or so. Yeah. I didn't watch it. And then this is a little blue. But the other thing I remember was that there was a woman that I was dating when I first got here, when I first came to LA, who was an actress, a beautiful woman. And I think the show was on Sunday nights, right?
Yeah. At that time. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
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 And Sunday nights were off limits because that was, and I'm not making this up, that was the night she watched X-Files with her vibrator and pledged herself to David Duchovny.
That is the most relatable story I've ever heard anybody tell on this podcast. I have to be honest.
She pledged herself to David Duchovny every Sunday night. And I remember, like, she was a huge science fiction fan. She was really into Vonnegut. She was really into, like, Philip K. Dick. And she had this major crush on Duchovny and loved X-Files. And she would want to talk about it all the time, but I had never seen it, like I said. So I didn't talk to her about it. But I do remember, like, one time forgetting, like, that Sunday night was that night, and, like, calling her and be like, hey, you want to grab dinner tonight? And she's like, it's Sunday.
I think that you need to introduce me to this person. She should come on the podcast and tell us this story.
You know what? She would actually probably love that. And I'm still in touch with her, and I think she would be really into that. I'm not going to say her name.
Okay,
right,
don't
I better clear this.
Don't do that, yeah. But we're going to have to find this out, because I have a feeling that the Jen and this person and I are going to become soulmates. I just have a feeling.
I think so. And a lot of our listeners too can definitely relate to David Duchovny vibrator combination. So, absolutely. This is very much on brand for us.
You made my week with that story. I swear to God, that's so funny.
You know what I'm regretting having told you this is that I never mentioned it to David. I think if there's anyone who would have appreciated that story, probably David Duchovny. And I just blanked or must have forgotten about it.
He would have loved that. Oh my God. Well, like, you know, let's talk about it.
Let's hope he's listening.
Yeah. Let's hope he's listening. Yeah. Keep dreaming, Jen. I would love to hear some stories that you have from the, I would say from Requiem, the first episode, because you were brought back later as a recurring role for the following season. But when you first were on the show, it was the season finale. Duchovny was leaving. I don't know if you remember this all, but do you remember the vibe at all on the set? Like, was it kind of,
Yeah, I mean, I remember, the only thing I have to compare it to is all the many other one-hour shows I've been on, so I don't know if the vibe was different from one week to the next. What I do remember was that I don't think anyone was discussing that David coming, maybe they were. I can't remember about whether or not what the discussion was about David coming back or not, but I do remember that there was just general discussion about whether the show was coming back. And I think that was depending a lot on Jillian coming back. And I remember that she was negotiating her contract during those weeks that we were in.
Yeah.
So there were times where they wanted her on set and they would go to get her and they'd be like, wait, she's talking to her lawyer. Let's wait. Because that was more important even than the next shot was whether or not she was coming back. So, right. So the negotiations, I knew that negotiations were going on during those weeks, but I don't think anyone knew and anyone was discussing, you know, who was coming back and who wasn't. And I don't know if that was all signed and delivered yet.
Right. Because Jen, you probably have a little bit more insight on this because I came into the show much later, Judd. I didn't start watching until like season 8. Actually, your episode, This Is Not Happening, I believe was the very first X-Files episode I watched, oddly enough. But Jen was a watcher from the beginning. And you, I think you would know around season 7, around that time, maybe what was going on behind the scenes more than I do.
Well, not as much as Judd does. That's
right.
Sure,
right. But I just mean in terms of like from a viewer's perspective.
I mean, I think back. Yeah, I have a vague recollection of it all being very murky at the time as well. That I think that as fans, we just kind of assumed and hoped it was coming back for another season. But it was very much a mystery. And I think it wasn't until around the time that episode, the finale, Requiem, aired, that we actually found out that David Duchovny was going to be absent for a lot of season 8, but that Gillian Anderson was coming back and that the show was coming back. So
yeah.
So it didn't seem like too much of a mystery to us. We just thought it was just a question of when would we find out. It seemed like bad news that David wasn't coming back, obviously. But we just assumed the show was coming back in some form. I don't think we realized how close we came to losing Gillian as well. So I think that if we had known as much then as we tend to know now about stuff from behind the scenes, you know, with social media and all that sort of thing, we probably would have been a lot more nervous, but ignorance was bliss. And so I think we just kind of assumed everything would happily work out, and it kind of sort of did, not as much as we would have liked, but I think it was just as well we didn't know that Jillian was on the phone to her lawyer while they were filming Requiem, because we would have been super nervous then.
Yeah, that's probably true. Judd, I have to ask, do you have any recollection of if there was any sort of tension between the two of them? Between David and Jillian?
There was... I had a feeling that question was going to come up. I'm going to go back to what I was saying before, where I've been on a lot of sets, and I've seen real tension. I've seen people really fighting.
Yeah.
You know, someone on set that nobody can stand, so on and so forth. That was a very professional set on X-Files, and I didn't really see that.
Yeah.
I don't know that I saw them being best friends or anything, but they worked together very well and professionally. They're both consummate professionals. So no, is the short answer.
Yeah. I'm not
fighting, no bickering.
Not looking for dirt. I'm just curious because we always wonder as the show, as fans of the show, in terms of like, especially right around that time frame where everything was sort of contentious, at least in the media. So it just makes us curious. But moving along, did you have any interaction with Chris Carter?
I don't think I did.
No.
If he was there, first of all, I wouldn't have known who he was.
Right.
I didn't, because I didn't follow the show.
Right.
Did I at some point meet somebody named Chris? I have no idea.
Right.
I have no recollection.
It's
I know who
because,
he is now, but
right.
I didn't know who he was then.
Yeah, because he probably wouldn't have been on the set. Like, you would have been working with Kim Manners, correct, for the director?
Yeah, Kim, I had a lot of interaction with.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. How was it working with Kim?
Listen, I love that guy.
Yeah.
He was the guy I was mentioning in the audition.
Yeah.
And he was an old school throwback, like Sam Peckinpah kind of director. Like a wild cowboy kind of guy, and of a kind that you didn't see as often at that time. Maybe when I started when I was 12, you'd see directors like that, usually in movies, not in TV. This guy was great, and this guy was just in total command. And also, I have to say, because I didn't really know the show, yeah, I would try a take one way, try it another way, and he would always come running down and go, no, that's not the way to do it, and he would tell me exactly how to do it. I mean, he really knew the tone and tenor of the show and was able to convey that very well. And he was kind of nuts and fun. And at the end of the day, you know, he took everyone to the bar and he bought the first round, maybe the second round too, and he would get liquored up and he'd start wrestling people in the crew. I mean, this guy was
right. Where did this you guys film? I should have looked this up, but do you remember where it was?
Yeah, we were up in Big Bear for a couple of weeks.
Oh, okay. Okay, wow. I didn't know that. Big Bear. That's
yeah, so we were on location. We were, you know, I was in a hotel. Me and Eddie Kay were in a hotel. I guess the crew was all in a hotel. David and Jillian had some nice big houses that they'd rented for them. And Tia Leone was there with the baby and stuff like that. And it was nice. You know, it was Big Bear in the summer, so it was pretty empty. And, you know, on days when I wasn't shooting, I was bored out of my mind.
Yeah.
But it was beautiful.
So you were kind of up there, like, I don't want to use the word sequestered, but like it was several days or weeks or whatever that you were up there. They didn't just have you up there for your parts.
I remember it being a long shoot. Like, I remember it being 2 weeks. You know, the thing with that show was that they really had to cover a lot of stuff. And there was always stuff that they were shooting from another episode on like off days and stuff like that. It was a big show.
Right. It seems like it would be like a movie set, almost more of like a, each episode feels like a mini movie. So it does seem like it would take a while. So, do you know?
Yeah, it had a huge budget and there were several cameras and, yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Jen, did you have any questions about Requiem, before we moved on to This Is Not Happening?
No, I think you covered it really nicely there. I thought I'll just go on record, as a lot of folks know, Requiem is my very favorite episode of The X-Files, so I know it very well. And I love the character of Richie, even though it's a small role, I love him. I said to Annie early this week, every time Richie is on screen, I just want to hug him and like make him super something.
I was actually,
he looks like he needs a hug.
I was just saying to Jen too, I'm like, I actually just to, you know, prepare for tonight's interview, watched through those again, just the Richie scenes, just the scenes that you were in, and I'm like, his little arc is quite tragic. Like, it's actually like so sad, like
so
carrying
sad
through the first one into This Is Not Happening. Like, it literally ends with like your friend dying and then you're just sadly walking away, and that's like the last we see of you. It's really tragic.
Oh, that's right. It's funny because in my memory, the two episodes are conflated a little bit.
But yeah.
Right, he died in the first episode?
Well, no, he got abducted in the first episode. And then you spend an entire season off camera essentially looking for your friend. And then when you find him, he's dead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's very tragic.
Did I depress you a little bit? Sorry.
it's so sad, but so beautiful. And I love the act. So I love that. I love that whole story. I would watch a whole season of Richie stories.
Yeah.
Poor Eddie that he died.
Yeah.
He didn't have much to do in that second episode. You were the lucky one of the two of you guys because you got all the lines, I guess. So.
Okay. Yeah. I think I remember that now. Like they had to drag him back and he had to be a corpse or something.
Yeah.
I don't think he was thrilled about that, actually. He's a pretty big actor, Eddie K. Thomas. You know, like he doesn't want to be a corpse on some show. You know,
I'm trying to remember because that was probably right around the time when he was on American Pie, right? I'm trying to remember.
I think he had already been on American Pie, which I also hadn't seen. And I remember I kept bugging him. I was like, I know about America. I hadn't seen it yet, and I was like, what's it about? And he said it was about a bunch of like high school kids or something trying to lose their virginity. So I kept asking him if he lost his virginity in the movie. He's like, nope, I can see it. I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, was he cool to work with? I mean, I guess sounds like it.
Yeah, everybody was really cool. We hung out a lot. He was cool. And David and I got along really well because we had some odd things in common. So we talked a lot. You know, for one thing, we both grew up in New York City and went to New York City private schools. So, you know, he went to collegiate. I went to Horace Mann. So we were talking about baseball. He played on the baseball team a lot. And then we also, I had gone to Yale and was an English major, and he had been, I guess, a grad student at Yale in the English department. So we had a lot of the same professors, and we just had a lot to talk about because of that. So, and we're both bookworms. And
that's cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you both, I mean, we'll get to your book that you have written later, but it's interesting you guys both kind of took the same route from going actor to novelist.
I think their novels both came out at the same time, too.
Did they really?
Yeah.
They did. I actually read an article in which they are both mentioned in the same article, but like upcoming notable books. And
wow.
Both David Duchovny and Judd's book were both mentioned at the same time because they were both coming out at the same time.
That's really cool.
Was super annoying. That was really annoying. You got a lot more publicity than I did.
Well, we're going to do what we can to fix that right here, right now.
Yeah,
Thank you.
We will do what we can. So in terms of your recurring role, like were you obviously weren't expecting to get called back. How did that happen? Did they say, hey, you're back. You're going to find your friend. Like, do you remember how that came about, coming back the second time?
Yeah, my agent called me and they're like, hey, they need you on another episode of X-Files. Are you available? It looks like you're available. I remember it was that one was in the winter and I had a trip planned back to New York to see my family. So yeah, I just had to adjust the flights so that I would be back 2 days beforehand. So just in case I got snowed in, which I did. And yeah, you know, it's nice to get another paycheck without having to audition again. That's always great.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. Like you're not familiar with the show, but they do that a lot in terms of having the same actors coming back. And I think that maybe goes to say that it goes to the credit of the show. I think that they, you know, have such a good relationship with all you guys. Like everybody can come back, and it seems like it's, you know, kismet. It's kind of cool.
Well, I had a great time doing it, so yeah, I couldn't wait to come back. Sure.
Yeah. So when you came back in season 8, you were working with, I mean, you were still working with Jillian, but you had Robert Patrick now, and you had Mitch Pileggi, and it was still Kim Manners directing, correct?
Absolutely. I kind of have a really good story about my coming back to the, I'll try to tell as
Ooh,
quickly
good.
As possible. If you can.
You can take as much time as you want.
Yeah. Take your time, Jed. We're here. We're here for you.
So I was in New York and I knew I had to be back in like 2 days. And then we kind of had this thing happened back in New York when my brother got sick and I had to rush him to the hospital the night before my flight. And it was in the middle of a snowstorm and I rushed him to the hospital and I had to stay with him that night in the hospital until my mother came by. And I kept calling to see if the flight was canceled and it wasn't canceled. So I trekked out in the snow all the way to JFK the next morning and waited in the airport all day. And they kept delaying the flight. And then finally they canceled it. And I was like, oh goodness, I'm not going to be able to make it back on time. So I went back to my apartment, my mother's apartment in New York City, tried the whole next day to get on a flight, couldn't get on one. I think I had to call the production company and say, like, guys, I'm in trouble here. I'll make it back in time. And I think they pulled some strings and they got me on a flight that was going to land about 2 hours before I had to be on set.
Oh, wow.
And by this time, I was sick as a dog. I, you know, between the hospital and trekking through the snow and everything else, I had just like the terrible sore throat and cold, and I was on a bunch of cold meds and stuff. And I get on a flight. It lands at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night at LAX. I think I had my car there, or maybe not. Maybe I took a cab back to my apartment. Quickly took a shower, jumped in my car, and drove out to Simi Valley, which is where they were shooting, the scene that night. I imagine I'd read the script, but I'm not even sure that I did. I think everything was so rushed.
Yeah.
And sick as a dog on all these cold meds, they rush me through makeup. I get to the set, and there is so much going on. There's a helicopter, and there's cars, and all kinds of nonsense going on. And I haven't seen these people in a year. And Kim just comes running up to me and he's like, hey, Judd, how's it going? Listen, we got a scene here. This is what you're going to do. You're going to jump in that car. You're going to hit the gas pedal. You're going to drive as fast as you can. And you're going to slam on the brakes just before you hit the camera. Already, I don't like this. You're going to say your first line in the car. Then you're going to jump out of the car. You're going to say your second line there. Point to the UFO that's flying over your head. It's going to be a helicopter with a spotlight. Just point to that. Say your second line. Then you're going to run all the way down that valley there and then all the way up that mountain there. Say your last line there, and then we're going to say cut. We're going to shoot the rehearsal. You ready for this? I literally just gotten off a plane from New York, sick as a dog, my brother in the hospital, all this stuff. And I was like, okay, all right,
yeah.
Sure, let's go. everyone get to one. I get in the car, and it's a different car than the one from the episode before. And the car from the episode before was a stick. This car was an automatic. And strangely, I had never driven an automatic in my life. I had only driven standard my entire life.
Wow.
So I get in the car, and I just think this is really a bad idea. Everything here, this is really rushed. But okay, I'm a professional, and Kim, you know, respects me and everything like that. And all right. And, you know, he screams out action, and I slam on the gas pedal, and the car jets forward, and I slam on the brakes, and it skids and stops like just before we hit the cameraman, who's like literally like right in front of the thing. I say my first line. I jump out of the car. I say my second line, and I forgot to put the car in park.
Oh.
The car, we were on a hill, and this car took off.
Oh my God. It
took off down the hill, and everyone's screaming, "The car, the car, the car." And I had fallen down. I'm on the ground, and I'm watching this car really going pretty fast toward a row of porta potties. And I'm thinking, somebody's in there, they're taking a dump, and they're going to get killed by this car. And I'm start thinking, where is my car? Because I want to run back to my car right now, get in there, drive to LAX, go back to New York, and just do theater for the rest of my life. Because this I just really screwed up. And there's all these people chasing the car, and no joke, this stuntman jumps on top of the car, crawls in through the window, gets in, and pulls the parking brake and stops the car just before it hits the porta potties.
Oh my God.
And I stand up, and I'm just apologizing to everyone and apologizing, and they're like, no big deal, no big deal, back to one, back to one. They bring the car back. Kim comes running over and goes, put it in park.
I love it because in his mind, he's given you this really intricate list of directions, but that's the one he forgot.
Yeah, that was the one thing he forgot, which really he should, you know, I should have known.
Honestly, maybe
I'd driven an automatic like twice in my life. I'd always driven, the family car was a stick. I had to learn on a stick. And then I think I took the family car to California, you know, it was like.
That is amazing.
I didn't know.
I hope that somebody has that on camera somewhere, right? I mean, it has to be.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it should be. And then everyone was like, you know, telling me not to worry about it. They said that stunt man, he wrecked a car last week. So he's been looking for a chance to redeem himself. And then the next day we were shooting on the Fox lot. And when I got to set, it was dead silent. And Kim just said, Judd, how'd you get here?
Oh,
and
God.
I said, well, I drove. He said, where'd you park? I said, in the Fox lot. He said, because I thought I saw your car run out towards Pico about an hour. You know, everybody laughed.
That's amazing. I love it. Oh, my God.
That was the big joke for the rest of that episode, was about my driving abilities.
I love it. Well, now I have to ask, how many takes did it take, that scene?
I can't remember. We got it in the next few takes.
Right. That's amazing.
There was another shot, though, that I got injured on, and I hurt my leg. So I was kind of a disaster in the second, in that second one. And that might be a reason why that character didn't keep coming back.
I love it. No, that's amazing. I think that I love that so much. You are quite the storyteller, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Please tell us more. Sure. Do you have any more stories?
Yeah, I mean, well, beyond that, I can say that, you know, Robert Patrick was on that episode. David
right.
was not.
Yeah.
And he was really great as well, had a completely different energy than David. He was much more of a lively, energetic fellow. David's kind of low key.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas I can't say anything about David and Jillian having a bad relationship, I can tell you that Robert and Jillian had a really great relationship.
Oh, that's so really, nice. That's nice.
Yeah,
to
they seemed to really like hit it off. And then I also interacted with Jillian a lot more in that episode than on the first one. God, it's strange. I don't remember interacting with Jillian at all on the first episode, but on the second one, she was great and we interacted quite a bit.
Well, she was always talking to her lawyer in her trailer, right? So
yeah, she was negotiating, right? Yeah. On this one, she was having more fun. The best story that I like to tell about her is that, you know, when she would do her off camera lines with me, she would say like really sexually suggestive things to try to flip off.
Wow. Like what? Oh, please tell us, please.
That I don't remember. I just remember. Or rather, one or two things. I'm not going to repeat them. So,
wait, you mean like she's trying to get you to break, or like?
Yeah, totally.
Oh,
she was like totally trying to get me to break. So she would say like she said a couple of like sexually suggestive things, which I didn't know.
I have to tell you, you've just killed about 90% of our listeners. I just have to tell you by saying,
yeah,
in a good way, in a good way.
Oh, good. All right. No, yeah, she's. Yeah, she's really fun. She's got like a punk rock vibe to her, you know? She's
yeah. Oh yeah. That's awesome.
And she's such a great actress too.
She's fantastic. Yeah. Oh, you know, you're not gonna get any arguments from us here on that. Okay. So
yeah.
Don't worry about that. Do you remember, because you had a scene in that episode with her, Robert Patrick, and Mitch Pileggi. Do you remember any working with Mitch at all, or do you remember?
Not at all.
No, yeah. Okay.
No, I don't know who
He plays Skinner, their boss, bald guy, glasses, but it's all good. It's all good. It was a very short scene.
I remember that. Yeah. Now I remember Eddie Kay being, they had to cover him with some makeup, and he got to a point where he said, no more makeup. It was killing him. Like I covered his whole body in makeup. I remember Robert and Jillian being lots of fun. And I remember the various mishaps that I had on the set running around.
That's awesome, though.
Yeah.
I love it. I mean, and there's a scene, too, at the end of that where, you know, Eddie's on the table and he's dead. And you actually have you and Jillian actually have quite an intense scene. Like, you know, she's crying because she's doing the autopsy or about to do the autopsy. And you come in and you have to, like, see your dead friend. And it's a pretty intense scene. And that was like your last scene in the. What I'm trying to say is, well done, Judd. It was a good scene.
Thank you very much. That wasn't the last scene we shot, and that was not the scene where she said anything dirty.
Okay, right? Okay, that's actually good to know, because I would be like, is that really how she prepares for those scenes? Because that's some interesting insight. I love it though. That's
that is a great scene though, where the autopsy is taking place. It is very sort of intense and emotional. I think like every scene in This Is Not Happening. Where Judd is featured are great scenes because he's doing all the exciting driving in the teaser with all the driving and the running after the car, as it turns out. And I mean, like in Requiem, all he ever really got to do much was sort of amble about the woods for the most part. So then thrown right in the middle of all this like high action.
It's like exponential.
At the start of this episode.
Yeah.
And then there's like the scene, there's a scene set in a motel with those three actors, Jillian and Mitch and
Robert,
of course. And that's like a really emotionally intense scene, too. And it's all happening in This Is Not Happening. Those are like three of my favorite scenes, because I really love This Is Not Happening too. That's also one of my favorite. That's actually like in my top 10 as well. But both of those episodes are two of my favorites, and I love those scenes. I love what you do with the character of Richie in those scenes. I think they seem like super like I feel like there's a lot happening, kind of. Beyond what we're seeing on screen, you can kind of get this sense that Richie has been searching for his friend Gary for so long.
Yeah,
he's just like really feeling it.
We were talking about that before, that it was like the idea that you've been looking for your friend so intensely this entire time sort of kind of mirrors what they are trying to do with Scully looking for Mulder, and then the idea that you find your friend turning up dead, and then later in the episode she finds Mulder dead, and so it's like mirroring kind of what's happening with the main character. So it's just like a nice little arc. It's really cool, a really cool arc. Do you have any more stories regarding the X-Files? Because I would like to talk about your novel, but I love your stories so much that I'm hoping you have more.
I guess the only one, I'll add one more. I just one more that just popped into my head.
Oh, good.
Kim was the driving force of every episode on the set and everything else. It really felt like Kim's show.
Yeah.
In this weird way. I don't know if other people have mentioned that. I don't know what it was like when he wasn't directing, but Kim was just so in control, and it really felt like his show. And I remember at one point late in the day that we were shooting, he looked at his assistant and said, go get me a cup with that much vodka, and his fingers were really far apart, and that much orange juice, and his fingers were really close together. And, you know, he passed away, I believe, so yeah. we can say, he was a drinker, and he was a cowboy, and it was really fun to work with him.
Yeah, you know,
I can't get away with that on a set anymore, I don't know, but...
I think you're right that he did. I mean, at a certain point, he was on the show pretty much from the beginning, right, Jen? I mean, did he start like at the very big season one, or like was it later? I don't have this information,
yeah,
but he's.
I mean, very early. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what his first episode was, but he was right in there the whole time, and he directed a lot of really major episodes. Like he wound up directing the very last episode in season 9 before the revival came back, so
that doesn't
he directed
surprise
a lot of
me.
Major episodes,
yeah, yeah. Because it seems
well,
like he
yeah,
did
I hope
take
he gets the credit ownership. Because it felt like, again, I don't know, but it really felt like his show, and I'm sure it was Chris Carter's show and the writers' shows, but it felt like his show.
Yeah, that makes sense to me because all the interviews I've read is like he was just so close to it, and every interview I've read, people have just nothing but nice things to say about him, and so I love hearing those stories. This is actually probably the most personal stories that I've heard anybody tell, so that's really awesome.
Great director. I just remember him very well. I don't remember every director I've worked with. Him, yeah. I remember.
Oh, well, that's a ringing endorsement. That's really awesome. Yeah. So what exactly, I know you've done a lot of acting. I was checking out your IMDb, and you actually were on Big. I have to bring this up because you were on Big as a young kid, right?
Yeah. So I got started when I was about 12 years old. I'm going to tell this story as quickly as possible too. But literally a casting director was walking through my elementary school cafeteria looking for kids to be in a Woody Allen movie. And I was getting in trouble or in a food fight or something like that. She thought I was funny. She introduced me to Woody, and I had a very tiny part in Radio Days. And then a year later, she had me, the same casting director, it was Ellen Lewis and Juliet Taylor, and they had me come back and audition for Big, and I was up for the part of the best friend, and it was, you know, like 9 months of like working with Penny Marshall and Tom Hanks and everything, and then I didn't get the lead role that I had been auditioning for, and I was devastated, but they gave me that smaller part in the movie, which for many years was what people remembered me by and knew me by because it was such a successful movie.
Yeah.
Though to me, I was, it always bugged me because I always saw it as, well, I came in second place and got that crappy little role.
Well, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I can kind of picture the face of the guy who, the kid who got that part. And I don't recall him going on to being the next Tom Hanks. So,
you know, I don't think he was really into acting. He was like a child actor who I think his interests took him elsewhere after that.
Yeah.
But I was really, I got really into acting and, you know, shortly after that was doing an off-Broadway play and then did a pilot not long after. So that was how I got started. And I acted from the time I was 12 until I was about 32. So I acted for 20 years, but around the time I was 28 or so, around the time I was doing X-Files, to be honest with you, mm-hmm. I was over it. I wasn't, I didn't really want to do it anymore.
So how did you move into doing, writing novels?
Well, it was tricky because, you know, when you're like 30 years old and you have no real work experience other than acting, you know, how am I going to get a job? What am I going to do? So I figured I probably needed to do some other creative endeavor. So I started writing, and I knew how long it took to get good at acting. And I figured, oh, it'll take a while to get good at writing and keep for a little bit, but then I just didn't want to do it anymore. So then I started teaching, and I became like an SAT tutor, to be honest with you, and worked as an SAT tutor until my writing started to sell. And that's now I'm a working writer in Hollywood.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, you can draw on your experience too, even in acting, and translate that over to writing, I would imagine. So that's...
I haven't done that yet, but maybe at some point I will.
No. Okay. Well, you never know.
Actually, I shouldn't say that. I used to write short stories. Actually, one of the ways that I broke in was that I used to write short stories about a fictional actor named Julius Fishman, who was like a fictional character actor working in Hollywood. And those stories actually became very popular at one point on the internet. And So that was the little bit that I did write about acting, but I don't really write about acting much anymore.
Right. Well, your novel that you wrote, have you written one novel? The one that I have here is a science fiction novel, Love in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. That's an awesome title, by the way.
Thank you.
And that's 2015. Is this the year that you were competing with David's book? Is this?
I vaguely remember that they came out around the same time. I think there were a couple places where they were reviewed in the same.
Yeah, that's so funny.
In the same periodical or something. But
well, tell us about it.
Love in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction is about a guy who falls in love with an android that gets kidnapped, chopped up, and sold for parts. So he has to go around hunting down her parts so he can put her back together again.
Oh, that's so romantic. I'm a little... I'm intrigued. You've sold me. I got to go find this now.
The book did pretty well. And it was well reviewed. And look forward to it showing up in another form.
Yeah, hopefully. Okay. Ooh, a little bit of dirt.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I can't talk about it. There's an NDA, but yes, you can look forward to it.
Well, that's exciting. That's really awesome.
Ooh, can't wait for that.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. Is there anything else that you would like to plug, Judd?
Not at the moment. Right now, I write for a show called Killer Couples. It's on Oxygen. It's doing very well. And you can check that out if you'd like.
I've seen Killer Couples. It's very intriguing. I love crime shows, and I love it. I think, do you write, you've got writing credits for a lot of episodes, I think, for that particular series.
I write pretty much every other episode at this point.
All right, cool. It's well written. It always intrigues the heck out of me. So you're obviously a man who's skilled at many different kinds of writing.
I'm going to have to check this
out. Thank you very much. Yeah, no, yeah, science fiction and crime tend to be my two genres. So
nice.
And then one other film that should be going into production soon called The Locksmith, which is another crime drama. Nice. And I think that's about all I got to plug right now.
That's pretty cool.
Well, thank you so much, Judd, for coming on with us. And
yes, thank you.
Yeah, you guys, please, keep tweeting us at XFD Podcast at Twitter. And thank you so much for talking to us, Judd.
Hey, that was great. That was really fun. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. I enjoyed it immensely. It was a pleasure to meet you over the internet.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Judd.